So let me welcome all of you to this last International Inequalities Institute event of the year. And we're closing it with a golden key, as we say in Portuguese. My name is Francisco Ferreira, and I'll just be chairing the event today. The event is a book launch, book discussion for The Profit Paradox, How Thriving Firms Threaten the Future of Work, a new book by Professor Jan Eickhout. So let me introduce Jan and then the two discussants as well. Jan Eickhout is the ICREA Research Professor of Economics at the Universidad Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona. He's the author of this book and also of numerous research articles published in top economics journals. He's been a tenured professor at the University of Pennsylvania and at University College London, as well as the Louis Simpson Visiting Professor at Princeton. He's a fellow of the Econometric Society, the EEA, the Academia Europea, and he got his PhD in economics from the LSE. We're delighted to have Jan. He'll be in conversation with two distinguished panelists today. Tommaso Valletti is a professor of economics at Imperial College Business School, and also a professor of economics at the University of Rome, Tor Vergata, where he's on leave at the moment. He currently is the head of the Department of Economics and Public Policy at Imperial. And we're equally delighted to have Ioana Marinescu, who is an associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice, a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, the NBER. She studies the labor market to craft policies that enhance employment, productivity, and economic security. So fabulous to have this panel with us. Just before I hand over to Jan, a few admin notes here, logistics and admin things. As you can tell from looking at the screen, we have a live captioner and BSL interpreters at this event. To activate the captions, click the CC button, live transcript that you see at the bottom of your screens. You can get larger captions by using the link posted in the chat box. The event will run for about an hour and a half until 7 p.m. The speakers will have about an hour amongst them, with Jan taking the bulk of that, but about 10 minutes each for the discussants. And then you'll be able to ask questions, and you can do that by using the chat box at the bottom of your screen as well. If you can, please state your name and affiliation. Finally, but perhaps most importantly, you can buy the book, which you really want to do after you've listened to Jan, from the official LSE Events independent bookshop pages of Hackney, and the link's just gone on the chat. And there's the book, that's what it looks like. And it's on my, behind me as well, as you can see. So with that, just wonderful to have Jan, over to you.
Thank you, Chico. I just started to share my screen. I hope you can all hear me well. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thank you very much for having me here. Of course, it's very exciting for me to be back at LSE. LSE is a bit of a home to me, so it's great to come back. And I'm also very excited to be here in the International Inequalities Institute, because a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is about inequality, is also very international and global. So I think it will be very interesting for me also to hear the discussion from Ioana and from Tommaso, but on top also the questions from the audience that you might have. So one possible outcome is that tonight I learn more on the topic than you might learn. So I apologize if that's the case in advance. I can just tell you that I'm excited about it. So let me try and give you a little bit of an idea what the profit paradox is. I'm going to try and introduce it with an analogy. And the analogy is, if you think about one kid bullying another, then one child suffers. If a teacher in a classroom doesn't care, then, well, maybe 20 children suffer. But if an education system is broken, then millions suffer. And I would argue that today there's one system that's broken. And to find out which system that is, let me take you back about maybe 2 years, when I had a meeting with my friend Alex, and I hadn't seen Alex for a long time. This was before the pandemic, so we could still give a hug. And I asked Alex, you know, when I just met him, I said, how are you doing? How is life in California? And he says, well, you know, life's not good. He says, I'm moving out of California. I had to close down my business. I'm going to stop to be an entrepreneur. I'm looking for a new job, a new life where to locate. And as we go through this conversation, he explaining me what exactly has happened to his business. We see on one of the screens in the bar where we were meeting up, a news report. There was a news report about the Dow Jones reaching at that point 25,000. It's about 2.5 years ago. 25,000, and the news anchor was talking about how great this was for the economy, what a good sign and a sign of good health of the economy it was. And Alex, as he hears this, he kind of nods his head and he says, I mean, not for me. I mean, it didn't do this for me. This period of enormous growth in the stock market didn't translate to my startup. And even the bartender who was bringing us the beers was saying, you know, well, not for me either, because I've been doing this job for many years, since 2004. And the pay I take home today is about the same that I took home in 2004. So there's been no really change in my pay. And so the question here is, you know, how is it possible that on the one hand, we have this, let's call it wonderful development in the stock market that tells us, you know, the economy is booming. And on the other hand, we have people like Alex and the bartender who are going through, you know, quite the opposite. I mean, they see the opposite in their economic environment. And the answer is, I think that there's a system that's broken, and a system that's broken is the competition in the market economy. And the reason why this competition is broken is that we have a small number of large and dominant firms that have an enormous impact on the entire economy. And the impact on the entire economy that it has, I'm going to illustrate with a number of facts, and I'm going to illustrate with data. But basically, the bottom line of it is that it leads to inequality and polarization economically, but then therefore also socially. And so let me start with one of the facts that I kind of lead it with is, and let me look at the stock market, and let me show you the evolution of the Dow Jones. This is the Dow Jones, if you want, adjusted for inflation, which I think is the right thing to do. And this is the evolution of the Dow Jones since the Second World War, okay, since 1945. And let's take a look at what happens to the Dow Jones. What we see is that the Dow Jones is indeed, you know, evolving until 1980, where actually there's no real growth. And then from 1980 onwards, we see a steady growth. And in particular, since the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, we see an even sharper increase. We're at 36,000, we're probably going to get to 40,000, and who knows how much further this stock market index will get. But the important thing to think about here is, if you think about a stock market index like the Dow Jones, is to realize that this is only 30 firms, and these are large firms, and many of those firms are some of those dominant firms that are basically becoming big, not because they are innovating, which they also do, and I'm going to talk about the good side of what they're doing, but there's also, they're profitable and they're creating high stock market valuations in large part because they manage to stifle the competition. They manage to keep competitors out, and this allows them to basically be extremely profitable, and this has the implications that I'm going to talk about next for the economy. So let's talk about, well, the first kind of story that I mentioned is the story of the innovations. But before I do that, let me just give you an idea how the pie of the economy is divided. If you look at the economy, the surplus that generated the GDP, which is the same thing as the what we call the value added at a firm level, and you can think of the economy as being like an aggregation of all these individual firms, roughly about 2/3 goes to wages for workers, about 1/3 goes to investments, to machines, I call it here, but it can also be R&D and software. It doesn't have to be tangible. And then whatever's left over is profits. And in 1981, that was around 2%, okay, the average profits. What has happened since then is that, you know, as the pie grows, these profits have been growing. Okay, and so these profits, instead of 2% by last year, they were around, or 2019, rather, they were around 14%. Now, the important thing to take away from this is that not the, all profits have been growing. It's actually the profits of a small fraction of the firms. And when I say there's a small fraction of dominant firms, our research shows that there's probably worldwide, and these are all global firms, by the way, worldwide, there's about 400 firms or so that are dominant and large, and that create enormous profits. But this is a small fraction, because even in the United States alone, there's about 6 million firms, and the estimate for the number of firms worldwide is around 100 million. So we're talking here about 400 firms out of 100 million of those. And this is basically, these 400 firms are taking the lion's share of these profits. In fact, one of the other facts that we see in the data is that the median firm, if I would take, you know, the firm that's in the middle of this distribution of profits, is actually seeing lower profits today than it saw in the early 80s. So this is kind of the development that gives rise to not only these high stock market valuation, but it's important to keep in mind that this is for a small number of firms. And this affects how the pie is being split up. But I mentioned before, I'm going to come back to the story of the startup of Alex. I'm going to show you some data on the evolution of startups. If you look at the late 70s, about 14% of all firms were startup firms. And so these startup firms basically are all young, small, and dynamic firms, very much like the startup firm that I was talking about in Alex's case. And what happened to Alex in particular was that he had developed a software to facilitate peer-to-peer communication. And he was in talks with one of the large mobile device producers. And the talks went on for about 2.5 years. After the 2.5 years, as he said, he made them see the light, but they managed with their engineers to basically implement what he had developed themselves, and they decided not to take over his firm, and he had to close down because he couldn't compete with them. And that also led him to not try for a second startup because the first one had failed, and basically meant that he kind of concluded it wasn't worth to be in that startup market. Now, you think this is a time of fast technological change. This is the digital age. We see a lot of startups. And in fact, some of the large firms we're going to be talking about, whether it's Google or whether it's Apple from the 70s, or whether it's eBay or whether it's Facebook from the 2000s, these were startups at some point. And you would think that those number of startups have been growing. Well, the facts are actually saying the opposite. We see that the startups have been declining from about 14% of all firms to around 8%, nearly half. Okay, now, why is this important? It's important because we know from the data that startup firms are firms that disproportionately innovate, because they're young, they're also growing fast, and they tend to hire more young workers. Okay, and of course, if we have half of the startup, or just a little more than half of the startups that we had about 4 decades ago, you can imagine that this has implications for innovation, and this has innovations for the dynamism in the economy. And I'm going to come back to that. So the story of the startup of my friend is not just a story of one person. It's something that we see entirely across the economy for all startups. And the same thing goes for the story of the bartender. You know, I'm going to show you next some facts about what happened to the evolution of wages. And here I'm focusing on wages of production and service workers. And these are individuals who are about 85% of all workers. And basically, these are the ones who are not supervisors or managers. Okay, and I'm going to come back to what happens to those managers in the next graph. And I want to show you the evolution of these wages, how they compare to what happened to what we call labor productivity. That is, how productive the average worker is in the economy. And what we see in this evolution is that in the early years, wages and productivity until 1980 were evolving jointly, were evolving together. Now, what happened from 1980 onwards, there was this decoupling. The productivity continued to grow, and the wages of these production and service workers who are non-supervisory, they started to stagnate. And so again, this story of the bartender is not the story of one person. This is the story of, in fact, 85% of the workers in the economy. And this is something remarkable about this change that happened in 1980. As I said, I'm going to show you one other fact about wages. And this is now, I'm going to look at wages for different classes of people by their education. Education is, of course, not the best way to classify people to what we call measure their ability, their skill, but it's fairly illustrative and indicative of what's going on. I'm going to have four categories here. Those who have up to high school, those who have 2 years of college, those who have 4 years of college, and those who have more than 4 years of college, who might have a master's degree, an MBA, a PhD. And what I'm going to show is that starting in the early 60s, we're going to see the evolution of these wages and normalize them to be equal. And we're going to ask what happens to that evolution from the 1960s onward. And as you can see, they evolve initially until the 1980s quite in lockstep. And then from the 1980s onwards, we see that there's a separation of each of these groups. And you can already see that those with more than 4 years of college have actually done quite well. Their wages have gone up by about 50%. But even those with 4 years of college, they haven't done that terribly well. I mean, they've gained about 15%. And strikingly, those with 2 years of college, okay, have basically stagnating wages. And those with high school, and by the way, those with high school only is still a large fraction of those in the economy, their wages have fallen. Now, if you think about competition, and I argue that this broken system is the lack of competition. If you have competition, then basically wages reflect your productivity. We've already seen the decoupling between the productivity and the wages. Now, if you see the wages of people fall, that really means that their productivity must have gone down if the market were competitive. Now, even the lowest skilled workers, as we might call them, say a driver or a security guard, their productivity, it's unlikely that this has gone down. You would think that even, for example, in the trucking industry, productivity has improved because of GPS devices, because of monitoring devices, because the logistics allows, you know, this complicated problem of making sure that every trip going forward and backward is always loaded. That there's a way to make this more efficient that would also increase the productivity of that driver. Now, if we see, as this graph shows for the lowest educated workers, that their productivity or their wages have gone down, if we really think that this is not because of productivity, what else is it? And I'm going to argue that, well, because that share of the pie is distributed differently and there's higher profits that are going on. And I think that Ioana is going to later on, when she's going to discuss this, is going to have quite a few things to say about this, this too. So this is the evolution of wages. Let me move to one last fact, and I'm going to call this a fact that's really about what happens to businesses. Why? Because here I'm going to show you the evolution of what I'm going to call job reallocation. And this is the fraction of jobs within the firm. Okay, and this is taken an average over the entire economy that are changing. And the way you can have a change in the job is basically because, well, someone is fired or is leaving. It could be because someone is hired. It could be because someone is being promoted to a new job. And this job reallocation is a measure of how dynamic the economy is, how dynamic these businesses are. And we call this actually a measure of business dynamism. And what has happened is that the business dynamism measured through this job reallocation was around 35%. So 35% in the early 80s of all jobs were turning over one way or another. Now that measure has been declining and is now around 25%. Okay, so what we see is that this dynamism has been going down, and this dynamism is closely linked to what I was showing earlier in this decline of the number of startups, because the startups are actually the most dynamic of these firms. And this is related to what's going on in the economy and what's determining this business dynamism. So these are a number of, I would call, macroeconomic consequences of what I would kind of see as the cause, which is this lack of competition. Now, the question is, what has happened? What has happened, and in particular, why in 1980 do we see these events unfold? Why do we see the decoupling of these macroeconomic indicators, wages, job reallocation, startups? Why does it happen at that point? And what is it exactly that's going on? And I think the key word there is that we're talking about scale and scale that is driven by technological change. This is really the advent of the digital age. This is technological innovation in digital technology that really transforms completely the economy. Now, this has two kinds of effects on it. There's, I like to call it, in the movie of the economy, there's a hero and a villain. The hero part is that this technological change does a lot of things to create growth, to create productivity, to improve our lives in many different ways. If we, you know, just now see how we do things, we go from one place to another with a device in our hands that tells us not only where we are, but it also adjusts as we walk because of the GPS. It's, you know, these are things we couldn't imagine in the 1980s, not even in the 90s. Okay. And that technology has become so widely available and so common that it is enormously valuable to us as users, but not to speak of all the technology that is transforming the way business is done. Okay. And that's, in a way, the hero part. And many of the firms, these dominant firms that we talk about, these large firms, have actually been the pioneers, the trailblazers, if you want, in developing these new technologies. And that's why it's the hero part of the movie. But at the same time, many of these firms are also using that new technology to keep competitors out, to reduce the competition from other firms. And the way that happens is because they can exploit in this digital age these new technologies, because these new technologies really demand scale. They are global firms, they're firms that are active worldwide, and they're most efficient when the scale is large. Let me give you an example of a company like eBay, founded in the mid-90s. And eBay is a platform, and it's a platform that basically allows or facilitates the trade between people who have something for sale and people who want to buy it. And if I want to buy a secondhand book, or if I want to sell a piece of art, eBay is a good place where I can do that transaction. And that's a lot better than what we did before, going to the kind of a market on a Sunday morning where I can get some secondhand books. Of course, I would find something, but the likelihood that I really would find the book that I was looking for was very low. Whereas now on eBay, you can find all the possible things that are on offer. And this facilitating trade is, again, the hero part. But at the same time, the scale that is needed and the scale that makes this platform efficient has implications for what competitors can do. Because why is eBay doing so well when it's large? Because as a buyer, I want to be where all the sellers are, and as a seller, I want to be where all the buyers are. So it doesn't really make sense to have two half or medium-sized platforms. The best thing is to have really one big one where everyone is together. But that's the problem then for competitors. A company like Yahoo Auctions has been trying to get into this market, and what they're doing is they say, okay, eBay, you have this dominance in this market, you have 90% of the auction market, you can charge prices of 7, 8, or 9% as a commission for each transaction. Yahoo Auctions used to say, I'm going to come into this market, I'm going to, you know, offer you the transaction at 0.5%, I'm going to compete on prices. And the customer said, this is very attractive, it's much cheaper, but I don't want to go there because there's no one else there. And so you need that, what we call network effect, this large scale, in order to be able to actually make this platform valuable. So it doesn't make sense to compete with another platform because you can't get the customers to come there. Now, eBay used to say, the reason why we're so big is because we have a superior technology. That holds true, according to them. But if you look at what happened in Japan, which is quite the opposite, because in Japan, Yahoo Auctions was first, now has 90%+ of the market. And eBay, who's been trying to get into the Japanese auction market, hasn't been able to do that. So again, we see that Yahoo can be the dominant firm in one market, eBay can be the dominant firm in another market. And it's basically a problem of finding the being the first one to take that entire market. And so what we see is that in these markets, you know, and to use a metaphor that Warren Buffett has used, you know, a company and a valuable company, Warren Buffett used to say, when I invest in a company, the advice I give you is that you look for a castle that's valuable. I want you to make sure that there's a duke who's in charge of the castle, who knows the value of the castle, who knows how to maintain it. but above all, make sure that there's a big moat around it. And the moat is ensuring that no one can actually challenge the property that you have, can challenge the market that you have, can challenge this castle. And I think one large part of what we see that is going on with these new technologies is that these dominant firms have managed to create scale because there's a moat around them. Why? Because there's scale advantages, because there's these network effects. And this is not just in companies like eBay. This is, of course, in the social networking business. This is also true for companies like Google in search. But it's also in more traditional companies. I mean, in the beer industry, the network of distributors has also generated some large companies like AB InBev that have about 35% of the world beer market. And in some markets, they're up to 80 or 90%. So this is something that's widespread. As I said, it's a few companies that manage to do this. Most markets actually have fairly competitive firms. I mean, to make this spend, there are no such scale advantages. It's particularly those markets where with the new technologies, this leads to an advantage that allows you to exploit the scale. Now, it's of course not something new. It's something that we've seen in the past. There was fast technological change, if you want, in the around the turn of the last century, around 1900. Then the new technologies were rail travel, electricity, oil production. Okay, and what happened then was the first movers, Standard Oil with Rockefeller, moved into a market, managed to monopolize the distribution network, the pipelines of the oil production, and they basically exploited this first mover advantage of this changing technology to be the first ones to be in the market, but also to avoid that competitors could enter. The same happened with railway travel. Initially, there was many investors investing in railway lines, and people like JP Morgan managed to consolidate that. He dominated the railway market and was dominant then. Now, if you look at what happened back then, is in order to undo the dominant position of these firms, which by the way also generated the type of inequality and polarization that I've documented. What happened back then was that, you know, we had to go through two world wars and a Great Depression to get rid of it. And I'm pretty sure we can do better than that. And I'm sure Tommaso will tell us more about this, given his experience in the antitrust world for the European Commission. But let me just give you one example of a way in which we can do better than wait until the inequality and polarization gets so extreme, which is what I would kind of in a big denominator call interoperability, which is a way in which we want to separate the value of this large network from the operators. People sometimes say, you know, you have a funny Dutch accent, so it must be the case that you're in favor of splitting up these firms. And I say, no, one, I'm not Dutch. And two, I'm not in general in favor of splitting up these firms, because if the scale advantage is coming from having, you know, the value is coming from having this large scale, then if you're going to have two eBays, you're going to lose a lot of that value. So it's much better to use this idea of interoperability, that you have one network that is large and you have different competitors, which of course is going to require regulation. Let me give you an example of such regulation, which is the telecom market. My phone plan in the United States with AT&T costs about 2.5 times what my phone plan in Europe with Movistar costs. And you'd say, well, maybe is there a difference in the technology? There's not. I use the same device. The technology for them to the bandwidth they use is the same. 4G, 5G is the same. The cell tower network is the same. There's one difference, which is that in the European market, by regulation, the owners of the cell networks have to allow competing providers on their cell network. And what this does is, of course, you get entry of new firms. That's the first thing. And the second thing they're going to do is they're going to try and attract customers. How? By lowering their prices. Now, the owner of the cell network isn't going to be too happy about it, would prefer this not to happen, but it's good for the customer because it leads to competition and therefore lower prices. And not surprisingly, in the European market, you see many more operators, whereas in the United States, you have three big ones, basically. Okay, and there's this dominance because AT&T doesn't have to take any competitor on its network. And this idea of separating the sources of the scale, the network effect from this digital technology and separating that from the providers and the operators is, I think, a general principle that we can apply not just to mobile phones. We can also apply it to different sectors, different markets in which there are dominant firms. It's, of course, not going to be the solution for everything, but I just want to illustrate that there are solutions, there are ways in which we can use regulation in order to promote competition. Ultimately, the objective is to create more competition, because it's the lack of competition, and this may sound contradictory. We have all these negative outcomes on the labor market, on startups, and it's through more competition that we can actually create or undo these negative consequences. And as we've seen in the past, these negative consequences don't need to be undone through dramatic and drastic developments. There's ways in which we can do this with policy. So just to sum up, next time if you see a news report on a Dow Jones reaching new heights, probably 40,000, who knows when it will happen and how much further this can rise, I would like to invite you to think twice. Think twice about what this means for the economy. You probably will hear that this is great news for the economy, that, you know, stocks are high, so our companies are doing high. But if you realize that this is a small number of dominant firms that are so profitable and therefore have such high stock market valuation only because they face very little competition. The fact that Apple is worth $3 trillion is in large part because they managed to consolidate their position of facing very little competition. And again, you know, we don't want to have the solution that we had in the beginning of the last century, wait for disaster for this to resolve. As they say, history rhymes, but it doesn't repeat. So I think it's up to us to think about the possible solutions. And the possible solutions, in my view, come from separating really the sources of scale and the network effects that are positive from those who operate on it. And we want really competing operators on those networks. And this eventually will lead to, you know, wages going up. Ioana is going to talk, I'm sure, about other sources in which many of these firms look at reducing the wages for workers. But there's also just the fact that there's competition for the goods that they produce, there's competition in what they are selling, has positive effects on the wage level already. That's one thing, but it also leads to more startup, more business dynamism. And remember, startups are the building blocks of the economy. They're the ones, the firms that grow faster, that innovate more, and that hire more young workers. And ultimately, that's the positive effect that more competition has on the economy. Thank you. I'd be very happy to listen to your comments and to take your questions later.
Thanks very much, Jan. That was a really interesting story, very eloquently told. So let's turn, without further ado, to Tommaso. Maybe, Tommaso, at most 10 minutes, please.
Okay. So thank you very much. I'll also start with a praise of the London School of Economics. Actually, Jan, Chico and I were about 25 years ago at the LSE all together. We overlapped in our PhDs, so it's a pity we cannot be in person together, but it's fantastic to be on the same event. So disclosure, we are friends. Other than that, I will comment on Jan's book, which is behind me, an exceptional book. I'm an academic. I was also for 3 years, from 2016 to 2019, the chief competition economist of the European Commission. So I do like policy. And when I started my job there at the Commission, I was invited, as you might expect, in Brussels to a lot of workshops, events. They want to talk to you, they want to lobby you. And when I was accepting, I wanted to talk about interesting stuff that was happening in academia. And Jan at the time was working on some paper on increasing margins, which is part of what's in the book now, with co-authors. And I started presenting his stuff in Brussels. And I can tell you that created a shock. That created a shock. There was a scandal because it was saying that something was happening in markets and something was not extremely healthy in markets. And since I was dealing with with competition issues to an audience of competition experts. That was something that really attracted the attention of many people. Not only it was talking about markets where, you know, market power was on the rise, but it was also saying that concentration in markets was having an impact on wages. And again, this is something that as a competition expert was almost anathema. Workers are never in the equation of policymakers. We look at prices at best, sometimes at innovation, and that's about it. But the impact on workers, this is not typically, which is a disconnect between what the economists, labor economists have done for 30, 40 years. And you will hear from Johan, of course, on that aspect. But it was really refreshing to see how an economist like Jan, who's not in an expert in industrial organization, which is the quintessential field for competition, was bringing new ideas, new evidence, new global evidence, not just about the US, but about more or less every industry and every economy in the world. So there was a shock, and lots of resistance. And I will comment a little bit more on this resistance because it has interesting implications. So people really wanted to push back any novelty and any implication of what Jan was finding in his research. So this is one of the big impact that Jan had on the competition policy arena. Another example that I may want to bring from my own personal experience, and you will see the consequences of that, is, for instance, when I was working, I was doing all the big antitrust cases in Europe over that period for 3 years, 2016 to 2019, involving some of these big tech companies that Jan was talking about. So we ran three cases against Google, we open against Amazon, against Apple, etc. So and in one of the cases against Google, the interesting thing and the paradox is also that for the first time I could actually see data, because as an official or the commission, we had the power to ask for data requirements from the companies and analyze data. And that was a paradox because this is the biggest trove of data ever out there, and no independent researchers has even been able to have a look at the data that these companies produce. And there is a debate whether these data are our data, are they their data, but it's something that typically independent scholars cannot have access. So, but by looking at the data, I could see that there were lots of behavioral issues. So in principle, this platform should bring lots of reduction in the frictions, increases in information, they should be super efficient, something that Jan was alluding to. But in practice, we see that there is behavioral issues in the sense that whatever you are shown with good graphical content on the first image that Google is showing you on the search engine that captures your attention, that's the end of it. So we had data by looking at what happens to links which are shown to page 2, page 3, page 4, no one ever goes there. So a bit different from the idea that consumers are hyper-rational, they make efficient choices, they look at whatever is available, and then they decide. So really behavioral stuff. And when I was commenting on this with another academic friend who's a social psychologist, he was telling me, oh, how interesting. But this is something what we social psychologists have been knowing for 20 years, because we run experiments, we've done experiments in the lab, and we know exactly if you place something on top, on the bottom, top left, the bottom right, the people behave in different ways. So A-B testing is well known in social psychology for many, many years, and it has implication on the consumer behavior. But two interesting observation come from that, which is, one is how come the results of the social psychologists, how come these results never came to the attention of the policymaker? And similarly, when I was talking to my friend in social psychology, he was not aware of any debate in competition policy, market concentration, changes to regulations in a digital platform. So completely disconnected from the policy domain. So something that I learned, and this is where Jan comes into the picture, that I learned in my job as a policymaker for a while, as an enforcer, is that there is this huge distance between academia and policy. policy is lacking diversity, is lacking completely diversity, and at least I'm talking for my field. They talk to lawyers, they talk to advocates, they talk to corporations, they talk to a few consultants, and that's about it. So I mentioned the impact on labor, the impact of inequality. That was something that was completely out of the radar, outside the radar of competition authorities. And secondly, also many of us academics, we are not even aware of the big policy questions which are ongoing. So we really need to connect those two fields, those two important domains much more. And there is, and we are not yet there. We are not yet there because there is a collective action problem. It's great to have a person like Jan or myself or Joanna now and then on some policy talks, but that's not the organization that you need. Academia collectively sometimes has to become more assertive. Okay, we reason in terms of paper. My paper says that, and that's about it. Okay, more research needs to be done, and more research needs to be done is a death sentence to policy changes, because there is also a structure of power that they will tell you, oh, good academic, pat on your shoulder, come back 5 years from now when you will have discovered what the real results out of your research are. But in the meantime, policy choices are being made. So something where Jan comes in when he's telling us that something happened, something radical happened to markets. I wouldn't say that Jan ignores it, but a big element is that technology is not some inescapable thing that happens out of nowhere. Policy has an impact on it. So technology came the way it did because we made policy choices. So we decided collectively, for instance, to tax wages and not to tax capital in a certain way. So these were choices that were made by us. We decided to under-enforce competition policy. It's not just the abuse cases that you mentioned, Jan, but it's also over the past 20 years, the GAFAM, so the big tech were allowed to buy 1,000 companies and zero have been prohibited. I should readjust this number 1,000 to zero, because just 3 days ago, the CMA, which is the UK Competition Authority, finally blocked the first merger, the acquisition by Facebook of Giphy. So now I'm going to say 1,001 to 1, but it's like scoring a goal when you're already down 1,000 to 0 is not a big change. So we have to understand that technology came the way it did because we made a choice. So we cannot simply say it just came along. The other point that people like me, people like Jan, I think all of us have to reflect upon is that we strongly believe that competition is a good thing. Competition is a good thing because it means diversity, it means resilience, but it's a message which is very difficult to express for common people. If you ask around and you say, do you want more competition? Ask really the lay person in the street. They will resist that because people associate competition to globalization and to all the results that we have seen from unregulated competition, from the dominance that you have found in your research. So we need a narrative to tell people that this has a real impact on individuals, which may be cheaper prices, perhaps even better wages, but people are afraid. And if you say more competition, you may lose them. So since we need also a political change, you need a political narrative to make sure that the good message is not lost in a bad translation, and then people misunderstand what we are talking about. The last point for now, perhaps, is also that I forgot my stream of consciousness, but the last point that I want to make is also to say that I am, when it comes particularly to digital platforms, I am a bit, I'm not fully confident that simply empowering individuals is going to create a big change, because of the business model of these many companies having multiple sides of the market and so forth. Often the what seems like a good deal to us, so the good which is supplied for free access to the search engine, to the social network, or the cheap ride on Uber, comes at the expenses of other people. Okay? So it's cheap to drive on an Uber because the driver is being exploited. That's why they can keep the fares so low. It's cheap to buy on Amazon because the fees that the merchants have to pay in order to be there are extraordinarily high, 30%, 40%. And it's difficult from an homo economicus perspective to make me change. You can make me reflect by telling me that my cheap ride comes at the expense of the exploitation of the driver, but I'm not sure many people would care about that. So simply informing, so the bottom line and the last point I want to make for now is that we need regulations for those things. It's not going to be competition alone. We need some more direct regulations of the business model of some of these companies, because otherwise competition as such cannot be the answer. I'll stop here.
Thanks very much, Tommaso. Jan, maybe, yeah, exactly. You have unchaired. Very good. Thank you very much. Okay. So, Joanna, please, over to you.
Yes. So I'm also very happy to be here. This is a whole LSE reunion club because I myself, I'm an economics PhD from the LSE. So there we have it. So for my brief comments, I want to focus on the US specifically. So I think that will complement Tommaso's remarks about the European context. And I too was excited about Jan's papers on rising markups in the US. It's really quite spectacular how these markups, meaning, you know, how much firms make you pay above and beyond what it costs them to produce products, have been rising in a quite spectacular way in the US. And in his paper, he argues that can contribute to wage stagnation, which has been a huge issue in the US, with, as you've seen in the slides, the wages of most people not rising very much, and in some cases, like for the wages of high school graduates, actually declining. So I myself contributed with my academic work and also with policy papers and talks of looking specifically at how this issue of competition that Jan's book very much brings to the fore, how does that affect workers and labor markets. And so I'm gonna make three points today. The first one is that in the US specifically, today's labor markets are monopsonized, meaning that generally speaking, workers are getting paid less than their productivity, what they contribute to their employers, and that a lack of competition among employers contributes to lowering wages. And that's exactly what Jan was saying when he was saying, well, can we really believe that worker productivity has been going down over time? It may not have, but it may be that their wages relative to the productivity have been going down because firms have more power to suppress their wages today than they had perhaps in the 1980s. So that's my first point, that, you know, yes, there is monopsony power. Workers tend to be paid less than what they contribute to production in the US today. But secondly, when we look at the evolution over time, since 1980 in particular, you've seen there was a big trend break at that point in terms of wages becoming decoupled from productivity. And that's also when profits started to increase a lot more. How and why exactly all this happened is not yet fully understood. And we labor economists are still, you know, working on that. And that's probably some role for competition, but there might be interactions with other institutional aspects such as unions and minimum wages, where the weakening of these other institutions strengthens market power on the firm side. That they are now, even if, you know, the market power might not necessarily have changed very much, they can exercise it more because there's no countervailing force, or less so than they used to. And third, I want to end on an optimistic note, which is that I believe that US antitrust policy can address some of that issue, and that a strengthening of antitrust enforcement, especially the kind of antitrust enforcement that will foster more competition in the labor market, can in fact today help us increase wages for workers in the US labor market, and presumably in other places as well. I have also worked on France, showing that even in France, where institutions are much more pro-worker relative to the US, there too we see significant monopsony power, with workers being paid less than their marginal productivity. So The first point then is about today's US labor markets and how, you know, we've seen that it is not the case that workers are paid exactly at their productivity according to what, how much they contribute to firms' bottom line, but actually are typically paid less. So, you know, in my own work, I've been, you know, able to show that, you know, that is the case, just looking at the fact that, you know, how can you understand this? There's several reasons for this. But you know, one of them is simply put this way, and sort of this sums it all, which is that from the worker's perspective, you know, it's not as if my employer underpays me, there's some other employer that is essentially the same to me and will just pay me more. And I can say, well, bye-bye, up, I'm going to the neighboring employer, they're gonna pay me more, I'm gone. That's not how the labor market works. In fact, most workers don't have a readily available alternative job that is similar in all respects and might pay them more. And that allows the employers to have some power to pay them less than their productivity. And we show that indeed that this power exists in the US labor market. Another reason why, you know, more specific reason why workers don't necessarily have other options or not many other options is this issue of concentration. So if a few firms dominate labor markets. Now I'm talking about not how, you know, how much they may be selling, but how many workers they're employing and recruiting. So if there's just a few firms that you could be working for, it's not easy to make competition play and say, well, if you don't pay me, this other company will pay me more, because maybe there's just other two or three other companies and they might all be in cahoots to keep wages low, depending on specific, you know, features of the labor market. In fact, we find that 60% of US labor markets at least suffer from low competition in the sense that there's not many distinct employers that that try to hire workers in those markets. And then finally, we've also shown that higher labor market concentration, so a decrease in competition for workers in a given market, lowers wages. And others have shown, more importantly and policy relevant perhaps, is that mergers between two companies, and we've seen a huge wave of mergers and acquisitions over time, those mergers, of course, they reduce the number of employers that compete for workers. And when that happens, when this reduction is important, that's when wages of workers are lowered. So that, you know, really shows a specific mechanism how workers' wages decline. And we've seen, you know, in your graph how workers' wages have been stagnating or declining for many categories. However, as I said, in the academic literature, we're not completely clear on the exact determinants of the evolution of wages over time. So is it, are workers really getting more exploited? By how much? Why is that? It's still a little bit unclear. You know, all the ins and outs, there's many reasons behind that. And besides competition potentially declining, there are two other, you know, which the evidence of competition, the labor market declining is a little bit unclear. For a number of reasons that we can talk more later if you're interested, but there's other factors, for example, unionization. My work has shown and others that when you have stronger unions, then firms, even when they have market power, when they would be potentially able to exploit workers, cannot exploit them as much. So they cannot lower workers as much because unions act as a, you know, countervailing power in that specific case. And so since 1980 particularly, so it's interesting the timing, the union membership has accelerated its decline in the US. And therefore any given level of market power that firms have is magnified by not having this counter power in the form of unions. Similarly with the real minimum wage, federal minimum wage in the US, it has declined since 1980 as well, much more strong. So again, that means there was a floor that would prevent employers who have market power from lowering wages below that, but now this floor is going down and down. So that's another factor that might play into the picture in understanding why we had wage stagnation, even wage decline for some workers. And finally, on the optimistic note, hey, we can do something about this. And one of the levers we can pull is antitrust policy. I know, and I'm going to focus on the US here. And in fact, President Biden signed an executive order on promoting competition in the American economy in July 2021. And in this order, you know, there's a number of things, but some of them specifically focus on workers. And one of them is to review. So in the US, we have this horizontal and vertical merger guidelines that tell under what conditions firms are allowed to merge because they are believed not to significantly reduce competition. And mergers can be blocked by the antitrust authorities when it's believed that they're going to have severe adverse effects on competition. But until recently, nobody was worrying about workers in all this. You know, what if two firms merge and now workers have so, you know, such a decline in the number of employers that they could look at for looking at a job and therefore, you know, find themselves in a worse position that would lower their wages. So that one of the things that is going to be considered is to change the rules. Well, actually not really change the rules. It was already implicit in the existing rules, but clarify. I wouldn't say change, but clarify that labor market effects are one of the things that should be considered when looking into whether two companies should be allowed to merge. Another issue that this competition order that Biden had addresses is the issue of other impediments to competition and workers' ability to change jobs. Because remember, the less I'm able to change jobs, the more I'm stuck in this job and my employer can pay less. So another thing that's going to be important is something like non-competition agreements. So these are agreements that workers sign that say, once I leave my employer, I will not work for any competitor, usually within a certain geography and within, say, 2 years after leaving this employer. Obviously, this can severely limit workers' alternative options and therefore allow employers to underpay them because by contract, they're not allowed to go work for a competitor. And the order says that they should curtail, that the authorities should curtail the unfair use of this non-competition clause, because this have been used for low-skilled workers like sandwich makers. So there's no justification in terms of, oh, they're gonna take a secret to the competitor. They've just been used essentially to reduce this workers' bargaining power, their ability to leave and their ability to obtain better wages. And so I think that the strengthening of antitrust enforcement in the labor market is one tool that can be used to, you know, act against some of the negative trends that Diane has identified and help us particularly to improve the situation of workers and raise wages. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Joanna. Thanks again to Jan and Tommaso as well. And I can't help but comment on the fact that it's amazing that these economists working on regulations and enforcement are very good at following the rules themselves. Never before ended so close to exactly 1 hour. So you guys followed your time perfectly. Thank you very much. So now I'd like to, you know, encourage the audience to ask their questions through the Q&A function. We have two questions there already. What I propose we do to the panelists, if you guys agree, is I'll group the questions into three and then go back to you, and Jan can take a little more time, but we'll also go back to Tommaso and Joanna for your views on things. So let me start with these two questions that I have here and then add one of my own, and then we'll go back to Jan. And of course, feel free when I go back to you guys to, you know, engage with one another again. So Jan, if you want to respond to anything that Tommaso or Joanna raised, you know, feel free to do that. So the questions I have, Bindu Venkatesh asks, I think when you were talking about the Dow Jones, he asks, does the practice of buying back shares also drive wages down? Does the practice of buying back shares also drive wages down? Is inequality an outcome of this? Lucas Papercorn asks, Jan, in case of technologies where interoperability is not possible, or data sharing is too costly or cumbersome, would you recommend price regulation of the dominant firm's products? And then my question is on the labor market stuff, and it's to Jan, but also to Joanna. Of course, Tommaso's views are always welcome. But you know, when you were talking about monopsony power, I was thinking there are other explanations. And then Joanna, you mentioned some. You mentioned the sort of labor market institutions ones, unionization and minimum wages. But I was thinking of the sort of, you know, for lack of it, more people than him, but the David Alter wage polarization story, in which you have technology having an effect that, as I understand it, is perfectly consistent with competition, which is just that these machines and digital software and everything replace a bunch of routine tasks, right, and are complementary to other people. So the demand for occupations gets polarized into either lower ranked occupations or higher ranked occupations, that whole story. And I wonder if any of the work that you guys have done, either of you, has been able to quantify the effects of one against the other. Often we, you know, when you do sort of causal identification work, one is interested in the effect of a particular thing, but it'd be important to, I think, it'd be interesting to compare those two effects. So that's my question. Let's go over to Jan. Thank you.
Okay, thank you first, Tommaso and Joanna, for the wonderful discussion. I'll try to kind of weave in some of my responses to you as I go to the other ones, but let me just start out by saying that the points you make are all very important and relevant, and I think I agree with everything what you said. I think it's important to look at a much broader set of issues than just the ones that I've been talking about. Let me first go to the question by Bindu on the buying back shares and what an effect this has. My understanding that the share buyback kind of craze of the early 2000s, I think it was, is that it's for fiscal reasons, that there was basically tax advantages from doing that. I would say that, you know, the fact that any given firm, if it decided to buy back shares, it wouldn't really make a difference. It would change their stock market valuation, but not necessarily the amount of profits that they create. Once taxes are involved, of course, it does have an effect on the economy as a whole, because there's going to be less tax revenue, and therefore this is going to have distributive and also efficiency implications, both if you want first and second welfare theorem, as economists we would call it. So the answer is, will it have an effect on inequality? I think the answer is yes. I haven't seen any research that tries to quantify, that's trying to say, you know, how big this is. Again, I would say an important thing is it would work through the taxation channel. But I would also say that I would like to see more research to see how big this is and how important this is. Lucas's question about the interoperability, if that doesn't work, can price regulation work? I mean, if I think in a way, price regulation is something that as economists, we have a hard time kind of dealing with, because we think, well, the price is really the tool that companies use to compete. And if you're in a competitive world, then of course setting the prices is a way to compete. And if you're going to regulate it, that's a problem. But if I think of, for example, the platforms, then the example I've given about the use of competitors of the cell phone network, ultimately, that's a form of regulation that involves setting a price, because the regulator says how much the user of the cell network is paying to the owner of the cell network, and that price is determined. And in some sense, regulation is always going to involve some determination of the usage, for example, of this network. So I think interoperability and this price setting are or price determination, if you want, are closely related, because it's if you want to think of, as economists, again, as mechanism design and market design, how do you want to design a market that's going to be competitive? It's always going to try and involve ways in which we can change the price setting behavior of these individuals if there are distortions, whether it's because of externalities, because of market power, because of increasing returns to scale. So I think that price setting is actually an inherent part of that. But of course, it's not necessarily saying, you know, I'm going to force you to set a minimum price or a maximum price or something like that. It's going to involve something that's going to be the result of the type of goods that you sell, how many you sell. It's going to be something more indirect. In fact, I think Tommaso quite rightly said it's a lot is about not just creating more competition, it's about regulation that eventually should lead to more competition, but you know, a key policy tool or policy lever is going to be regulation. Then to come to Chico's point about the labor market, and, you know, again, just to weave in the response to Joanna, I completely agree that monopsony is a huge issue, that institutions, whether it's unions or minimum wages, are also an important development that in fact started to change in the 1980s. And as Chico is now saying also, what about wage polarization? I think that the graph that I showed of the lowest skilled workers having a decline in their wages, if it's pure wage polarization or the skill premiums changing, which is kind of a different version of polarization, clearly that creates inequality, but it's technology driven. And it's technology driven in the sense that those people who have higher skills, and it's kind of a bit of a bad word, but let's say the people who are more productive, they have become relatively more productive with these new technologies. Because if you're a coder in Silicon Valley and you find a new algorithm to solve something, this is now going to be sold immediately around the world, and it's going to have an enormous economic implication for the product that you're working on. Whereas if you're a driver, or if you're a security guard, what you do, or a waiter, what you do affects, well, where you are locally. It doesn't have these huge scale effects that are going on. And I believe that the polarization story and this, the skill bias technological change are really technological changes that create inequality. And that's still there. Part of that increase in the inequality is there. What these stories cannot explain without monopsony or without market power in the output market is the decline in wages for productivity that has changed the same. If you believe that a security guard is as productive now or more productive than 40 years ago, or a driver, a truck driver is as much or more productive today, then that person's wage cannot have fallen, must have gone up. And if we see that these real wages fall, then there's something else in addition to this technological change that is going on. We've done some research trying to combine the two. It's not exactly polarization, but skill bias technological change. I can give you the numbers. The determinant of technology is still very important to create inequality. What market power does is it adds some more to it. It creates even more inequality between the highest skilled and lowest skilled workers. But the main thing it does is it lowers the level of wages for everyone due to monopsony, due to output market power, because there's this effect that it basically lowers the demand for labor because these firms are pricing too high, or they're exerting the market power that they have on workers. And that has a level effect. In fact, there's research that Johannes were probably aware of looking at in the education industry between, let's say, called like the more low skilled and the high skilled, and there's both monopsony power for both of them. It's worked by Severson and Goolsbee. So all workers are subject to this market power exerted through the output market or to the labor market. And I think it's interesting to distinguish between the technological drivers of inequality, which are still there, which are important drivers, and the effect that market power has on the level of wages for everyone. And I think that this is really about the decoupling of productivity and wages, whereas the technological change is much more about these differences in the productivity. As I was saying, if you invent even a minor change to an algorithm, it has huge implications. Whereas if you're a driver, it doesn't change more so than what you drive and what you do. So let me leave this here for those first round of questions.
Thanks, Jan. Maybe since we were talking about labor, let's change the order and go to Johanna first and then go to Tom.
Yeah, so, you know, I completely agree with Jan's point. I think the story is a multifaceted one where those technological changes, institutional changes interact with monopsony power, you know, to produce certain potentially quite complicated patterns, I know, that affect different groups. But something that I just think it's useful for maybe the audience to clarify is that when it comes to labor, a lot of people might think that, hey, if labor is cheaper, that's good for consumers, right? They might think, oh, you know, because I'm a company, I produce, my labor is cheaper, that's gonna allow me to sell, you know, products at lower prices, so that's great for consumers. But the interesting thing is that that's not how it works, certainly in our theory. In fact, it's quite the opposite, because the way that monopsony works is that firms, in fact, who have monopsony power, the more monopsony power they have, the fewer workers they hire and the lower the wages they pay. And so, and the reason why they do this is because essentially to hire one more worker, you have to attract them from outside. So you have to pay more and you have to pay all workers more. So then the trade-off for the firm is, do I have fewer workers and I exploit each one of them more by creating a bigger gap between their productivity and their wages? Or I have fewer workers, but each one only gives me like this sliver of profit, you know, over the value that they produce. And so the monopsonist prefers to reduce their size So that is optimal in terms of profitability. It's more profitable to be smaller and exploit each one of the workers more than to be bigger with a smaller margin, essentially, on each one of the workers. And so because the monopsonist reduces the size of the number of employees, it also is going to reduce the number of widgets that it produces, and therefore increase prices for consumers, because that makes production smaller, and that tends to increase prices. So I just wanted to clarify, because that I often hear people thinking like, oh, it's great, you know, workers are getting paid less, that helps the consumers, but certainly if the reason is monopsony, it actually doesn't help. It tends to increase the price of goods that are produced.
Deadweight losses and Harburger triangles, very nicely explained. Thank you, Ioana. So, Tommaso?
Thank you, Chico. Perhaps I'm going to make three comments. One, I will comment also on the question by Luke. What do you do if you cannot have interconnection, and do you price regulate? And the answer is, if the question is indeed what Luke is saying, so there are advantages from size because of some network effects, but it's impossible to have some kind of interconnection, yes, then the only solution is to regulate, because you do want the efficient market structure. If you were trying to split up among different ones, that would be inefficient, which means prices would have to be higher to recover the investment. So you price regulate. We've done that in the past with various degrees of success in telecoms, in water, in electricity, in railways. But we also learned after a while that actually it is possible to find points of interconnection. So the whole history and the whole success of telecommunications that Jan was alluding to, it's been possible to, I don't know, abandon the local loop or shares the tower cells and so forth, so that some kind of interconnection would happen in terms of investment. Plus, we did allow to, you can change your contract without changing your number, you can change your contract without losing your contacts, which is the kind of interoperability that we are trying to achieve in digital platforms. Now, if you download Signal, that's a great thing, but you're not going to use Signal because you need to convince all your friends, your mother, your all your chat groups are going to be lost because there is no interconnection and interoperability. So these are very pro-competitive type of regulations. You don't regulate for the sake of itself. You regulate in order to give competition a chance to make the market more contestable. So that's a good principle. The second comment on this overarching picture of increased concentration, increased market power in the markets, I think we should always try to divide in the discussion into two things. What are the causes of what we are observing, which is a more interesting research question for academic? Is it technology? Is it under enforcement of antitrust, etc.? And then what are the consequences? So I think if we take the picture now as of 2021, where we are, given the current level of concentration, the current margin, we should enforce more. No matter why we are here, no matter why we are here, I don't want to understand if there is a single cause, and most likely there is a multiple set of causes that have gotten us where we are now. But the implication is that going forward, we must change the way we intervene in many markets, which is the third point related to what Ioana said, that things have changed quite a bit in the United States under the Biden administration, and that's great, especially for a progressive person like I am. I have to observe, though, that the US has done almost nothing for the previous 20 years. The last antitrust case they ran was in the late 90s under Clinton. In particular, under Obama, it was a disaster. It was a disaster when it came to antitrust of big tech in particular. Why? Because big tech were the biggest funders of the campaign of Obama at the time. So the new movement which has been created, it's not by coincidence, it's called a new Brandeisian kind of antitrust movement, which is reminiscent of the name of Louis Brandeis, which was a judge of the Supreme Court in the United States more than 100 years ago, and the champion of the people, who said that antitrust was very important, not just for the consequences on the prices, but also for the prevention of political capture, which is very bad for democracy. So monopolies creates rents, and the rents can be used to pay politicians. And that's exactly what you observe with the lobbies, with the donations. There is a lot of money which is being spent because a lot of money is also being made. So we shouldn't forget also the political dimension, the political economy dimension, which is it's really crucial to understand what's going on in this market.
Thanks a lot. So we have an attentive and staying audience, but they're not asking more questions. So, okay, here's one from Paolo that's come up. Let me see if there were more in the chat before. I don't think so. So Paolo Brunori. So I'm going to ask Paolo's question and then maybe add another one of mine. So beside the problem of competition and prices, don't you think that ownership of private data about online activity should be limited in order to obtain other important targets such as freedom, psychological health, and social cohesion? So this is about limiting the ownership of private data about online activity.
So I'll go first on that one. And so I give time to Johanna and Jan to think about it. So this is one of the other dimensions where it's very interesting as an enforcer how disconnected the discussion was. So when I was dealing with competition cases, every time it would come to data and privacy, then the competition enforcer would say, oh, that's consumer protection. It's not for us. It's not for us, it's something, it's been taken care of by the GDPR, so the General Data Protection Regulation that we have in Europe. So we don't think about competition because it's the job of someone else. And this kind of approach is not useful because the business model of this mega digital platform is based on data, no? Collecting data, analyzing data, hyper-targeting us, creating business models which are engaging or addictive according to some. So you cannot understand competition if you don't understand the data aspect, which means that we need to have, when I was advocating for more inclusive conversation, is not just something which is good to say because it's politically correct. I need to hear, as a competition expert, the privacy expert. I need to hear the social psychology, because otherwise I don't understand the business model. In particular, I think there is an incredibly useful conversation that should happen, and it's not happening. Also, the lawyers, the legal scholars are very protective of their own turf. So we economists, we study economics. The legal scholars, they will tell us a lot of things about privacy being a fundamental right, which I understand. It's something which is appealing to me. Privacy is a right which is protected by a law. And if it is protected by a law, that's the end of it. However, as an economist, that's not enough. What does it mean? Can I measure it? Okay, so can I give, is there a trade-off? So what does it mean? So can some data be used according to some voluntary agreement of the individual if it generates a benefit to me? So the discussion which is not happening is the economist and the legal scholar. The legal scholar telling me exactly what the fundamental human right means, because I tend to attach measures. I try put the monetary value to it, which is unacceptable from the legal point of view, and I want to understand why. And at the same point in time, I would like the lawyer to try to understand my way of thinking of doing trade-offs, which is the way I am being trained. So this discussion is finally happening. It's very recent, so I find it exciting, but more of it should go along, because the policymakers ultimately, and that's what a policymaker should hear the legal view, the economist view, the psychologist view. It's not happening enough, and then put everything together to make a decision the policymaker is entitled to make.
Thanks, Thomas. Thanks, Thomas. So we'll go to Jan now, but Jan, as we go to you with Paolo's question, let me add a question that's come up here from Christian Tilsker. It says, thank you for the excellent talk, really inspiring. Jan, you mentioned the risk of depression and even war, I think depression in the economic sense here, and even more because of a lack of competition in the early 20th century, as a side note. Could you expand this view a bit, I guess, in terms of the current dangers?
Sure.
So those two to you, and then we'll go to Johan. Thanks.
Okay, good. Let me maybe pick up on Tommaso first and then come to the question about the early 20th century. I mean, I think that one of the main issues that Tommaso is raising is probably the most important one, is that we have to have a much broader view of exactly how to tackle this. If you're going to continue to think within the legal framework, within the psychological framework, within consumer protection, I think we're not going to solve any problems. The type of things we're seeing now is that market power comes from many different sources. So I think Bruno mentions data, but it's also, as he also says, you know, the psychological effects. How do they use their ability to make users addicted to social networks, for example, which, you know, is a source of creating market power, because, you know, it's not just Coca-Cola that gets addiction with their addictive drink. It's also now the social media that make us addicted to the way we get fed the information that comes to us. And you know, I think that social media and these issues, these psychological issues, are going to be the tobacco of the 21st century. In 1950s, we had doctors advertising the benefits of smoking for pregnant women. I mean, if you think about this now, it's just from a different world. And I think even in the next 10 or 15 years, it's going to be also from a different world to think that an Instagram can completely do whatever they want to make your users addicted. I mean, I'm addicted to many applications I use. I have teenage kids who are addicted to their social media. And this, we've seen even more exacerbated with the pandemic, has enormous costs, psychological costs that we cannot ignore. So I completely agree with Tommaso that we need a much broader view. Of course, what also was brought up earlier, there's this tight link between the, you know, what I call the vicious circle of monopoly and political influence, is that you have market power, you sit on a bunch of cash, you can use it to influence policy. If you can do that, this policy is going to generate more market power, and that is allowing you basically to create more cash to influence more the policy. And this vicious circle ends up in really uncontested markets. And this brings me to the question that Christian was asking about, you know, what happened in the early 20th century. Of course, we have to be careful by making comparison, but if you look, and this is both in Johannes' interpretation, also a positive note, if you look at what happened in Germany, the German economic landscape in the 30s was dominated by a small number of very large firms. And there was this implicit agreement that they could do whatever they wanted in their market. There would be no contesting their economic power, as long as they supported whatever the regime wanted them to do. And in 45, the big response that led to, I think, the German growth miracle was, we want this Mittelstand economy, this economy of small and medium enterprises that can compete, where these large companies somehow are going to be regulated. Now, of course, as Christian was asking, what happened in the meantime is that probably the Mittelstand wouldn't have had a voice to go against the Krupp or against some of these large dominant firms if this disaster of the Second World War hadn't happened. And I'm not trying to claim that the war was the solution to all the market dominance, but there's at least some clear examples where to solve this you know, this inequality, sometimes disasters have happened in the past. And I think, you know, echoing what Tommaso says, there's things that we can do. There is hope. There's ways in which we can do it. But if you're going to wait too long, the polarization and inequality that we see already is going to get worse. And this polarization is going to basically lead also to societal influences. We already see, you know, the Gilets jaunes in France. We see the voting patterns across all developed economies, where, you know, the people, they're basically disenfranchised economically, because, you know, if your wage hasn't grown for 40 years, you've got not much to lose anymore. And I think that we have to take that into account, that this extreme inequality that we're seeing arising has, of course, much broader implications than just beyond the economic. People are going to take decisions, political decisions are going to align with different types of opinions that is going to lead to negative outcomes. And I think this is something we really have to worry about.
Thanks, Jan. Johanna, I think you're going to get the last word. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I don't have anything specific to add here, but I do want to add one thing, which is that in the US, you hear a lot of people worrying about the fact that stronger antitrust enforcement could lower growth and productivity. And the argument goes that we are punishing the winners, right? These big companies, they are big for a reason because they are very good. And actually, there is something to that. In, you know, and Jan talked about this, the hero is the technology, and these companies, many of them have brought to us enormous, you know, improvements in our quality of life with some adverse effects as well, but certainly the technology is pretty amazing. But, you know, in thinking about policy design, yeah, this is certainly short-sighted. You have to see the dynamic aspect. And we do that too in economics, but it's easy to neglect it when you want to make the point that, oh, you should just let them be because they are the best. The thing is, once they are there, they can, in many ways, first of all, stifle competition and prevent entry from new rivals. And therefore, that can prevent more and better innovation in the future. And that's something that we should really work towards preventing that. Not to speak, of course, about the effects on workers, which, you know, I mentioned before. And then there's the political angle, similarly, that by being really powerful, they start to shape policy in a way that is self-serving. So we call that capture in economics, right? So and the bigger they are, and the easier it is to capture, you know, regulators, because there's only it's kind of like there's lack of competition, you know, in terms of lobbying, right? Like there's just a few big actors, and it's easier to get their way now in the political arena than if there's a more diffuse, you know, power across the economy. So I think it's a you know, complex balance to achieve, but we want to at the same time allow the big companies to grow and produce good stuff, goods and services that we want to have, while at the same time protecting, and that's sort of the goal of whole goal of antitrust, it's protecting competition, not competitors. We're not protecting anybody in particular, but we're protecting the vibrancy of this process, you know, that hopefully can lead to favorable social outcomes as long as it's, you know, correctly and, you know, expertly regulated in order for it to, in fact, lead to these beneficial outcomes.
Thank you very much, Johanna. I think we're going to end now. We're in perfect time, but I think we, you know, I said at the beginning that we would close the term with a, go out with a bang here, and I think we did. So I really want to thank Jan for a fabulous presentation, very, very nice, and Tommaso and Johanna for very clear discussions, and thank all of you for coming. And wish you all a good break, and see some of you next term. So thanks again to everyone, particularly to Jan, Tommaso, and Johanna. Bye bye.
Thank you, Chico. Thank you, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Buy the book. Buy the book.